Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my co-host and mother is with me today, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. It's a beautiful day here. I hope it is where you are as well.
And here is in Iowa, for those who may not know that, Southeast Iowa. why don't you introduce our guest today, Caroline?
Okay. Now, the book is A Wolf in the Family by Francine Falk Allen. And she is someone who has published many essays and articles in national journals. She's the author of Not a Poster Child, which has won gold and silver literary awards, and of No Spring Chicken, which was named to Kirkus Review's Best Books of August 2021, and plus many other awards. And she loves the outdoors, swimming, gardening, movies, literature, ancestral and historical research. And that this book is a testimony to that, believe me. So she resides in San Rafael, California, with her husband, Richard Falk. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And, you know, one thing before we dive into A Wolf in the Family, which is your first novel, published novel, I believe. Is that true?
Yes. The others are nonfiction, and this is the first fiction.
Okay. And the nonfiction were memoirs, and at least partially about your life as a polio survivor.
Yes, that's true. The first one is fully about that, and the second one is things that I've learned that make life easier as we age or if you have a disability.
And you facilitate a polio survivors group in Marin County and also a meetup writing group, and I think that's really interesting.
Right.
So, you know... Polio was, you must be one of, there must not be that many survivors of polio.
Well, there are probably 300,000 or 400,000 in the United States.
That many? Wow.
And more in other countries where polio wasn't eradicated as early.
I have to ask you, what do you think about the anti-vax movement?
Well, that's kind of off topic for my research. But I think it's deplorable. I think it's very dangerous. I've had most of the diseases that can be prevented by vaccines now, and even chickenpox. If you've had chickenpox and you weren't vaccinated before you got it, you can get shingles later on in life, and it's much worse than chickenpox. So I think that a lot of lives are saved with vaccination. So I am definitely not against vaccines. I'm very pro-vaccine, and part of the reason we need to be vaccinated is there's some people who are not able to be vaccinated because of their, you know, vulnerable health concerns. So that's, it makes it even more important for the rest of us to be vaccinated. So that's what I think about it.
Thank you.
Out of my experience.
I appreciate that, because I think a lot of younger people don't realize what it was like before vaccines.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course they don't. No.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a paralyzed leg, and I've lived with that for 74 years now, and it really makes your life more difficult than it would have been.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so A Wolf in the Family is based on a family story or a family secret, essentially. Do you want to tell us how this secret came to light and what your initial reaction to it was?
Sure. It's actually a number of family secrets. I found out about this after my mother had died. She never told me any of this. She had told me just a few vignettes about growing up in her family. She was the eldest of what she described as 12 children, although my grandmother had more children than that. Some were stillbirth. And so I was at a memorial service in Southern California for one of my many uncles. And I'm sitting across from my Aunt Dorothy. And in the middle of a sentence that was actually about something else, she said, "Well, when we were in the orphanage," and I looked at my cousin next to me, I said, "Did you know anything about this?" She said, "No, she'd never heard about it." I said, wait a minute, Aunt Dorothy, what do you mean when you were in the orphanage? And she said, well, Daddy put the five of us younger children in an orphanage, and it was like thousands of miles away from Ogden where we all lived, and he just left us there. And then she told me why, and it was jaw-dropping. So I thought, this is just too good a story not to tell. And it took me a long time because I talked to different aunts and uncles about what they knew about this. Not all of them, of course, but I gathered information before I finally did write the story, and I started writing in about 2019.
So how many of your aunts and uncles were still living at that point?
At that point, there were, let me think for a minute, about four or so were still alive. Four or five were still alive when I learned about this. By the time I started writing, they had all died.
Oh, wow. Did you feel more sort of able to tell this story because they were gone?
Yes, I did. And I thought, you know, I heard different things from different cousins, and some of us in that generation were told things to gloss over it and to make it sound like there were reasons that weren't the real reasons. And so I thought, well, you know, some of my cousins may not like this book, but I decided to interpret it with taking the facts and placing my own point of view on it. So, I felt like I had the freedom to do that since everyone had died. And I actually looked into the legality of it and learned that if all the subjects in a book have died, you can say whatever you want about them. Because their families are not legally allowed to sue you. And I thought, okay, well, I don't think any of my cousins would anyway, but now I feel a little safer.
How many cousins do you have? You must
have
a ton. Well, there
were about 24 or 25 first cousins, but some of them have died also. I mean, I'm going to be 77 in a couple of weeks, so, and I'm one of the younger ones, so there are lots of older cousins, and some of them have passed on now. And then, of course, they've had children and grandchildren, so it's a pretty
large,
you know,
family.
A large family, yeah.
I just wanted to compliment her on the way that she wrote this book, because there are so many characters in it, and she listed them in the front and in the families that they're in, and it made it so much easier to keep track of what's going on. Well, not all the time, but most of the time.
Yeah.
No, really, it really was a great way to do that. Great way to do it.
Yes, it was such a large family, and at one point another author said, you know, you could put a character list in the front. A lot of books do that when it's a saga, which it is, because it covers such a long time frame. And I did try to make each of the characters' personalities different enough that you would be able to sort of recognize who they were, and to also keep the primary characters prominent and not have too large a role for the secondary or the children, because only some of the children really had a strong role in the story.
So the kind of lead characters of the story are your grandparents, Frank and Naomi Wolf. Frank
right.
Wolf and Naomi, she was Wolf for a while, but Then their children, which would be all of your mother and then your aunts and uncles. How many of those did you actually know?
Of my aunts and uncles, there were two that I never met. And I had met all the rest of them. And some of them, a couple of them I knew pretty well. And the rest of them, I'm just turning the sound off on my other computer. I didn't to do that. And the rest of them I just had a passing relationship with. I knew them more as a child than I did later in life. Most of them lived in Southern California. I lived in Northern California, and we just didn't, for one thing, almost all of them came and stayed at my mother's house one by one as they grew up, because she was the eldest and moved out first and then moved to Southern California and got married. And they almost all came to stay with her one by one. And she didn't really appreciate that. So when we moved to Northern California, she was good with just Christmas cards. You know, she felt like she'd already taken care of them all of her life as a little girl and a teenager. And then she took care of them as a young adult. And she just felt like, you know, they'd stay in touch, but she didn't really want a real close relationship with them. She was kind of like her father, a little bit emotionally emotionally distant. And some of the other kids were much friendlier than my mother.
Mm. Now, your mother grew up primarily in Ogden, Utah?
Kansas and Ogden, yes.
Kansas and Ogden. And the family moved to Ogden because her father worked on the railroad.
Yes, and Ogden was a primary hub for the rails then, for Union Pacific.
But they were not. They didn't go there because they were Mormon. They weren't Mormon.
No, they weren't Mormon. My mother and I think at least two of her sisters did eventually become Mormon, but that was later when they were young adults.
And did that last?
Yes, they were Mormon the rest of their lives, and the whole family was very staunchly Christian.
Despite what was going on.
Despite what was going on, I know. Well, I think that's part of why they didn't tell the story, some of them. You know, they didn't want people to know what had gone on because some of it was not very, I don't know, I wouldn't call it very Christian.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, people are people. And I tried to write it with a sense of forgiveness for all the what you might call mistakes that were made, but they may have been the things that led everyone to have the life they wanted to lead in the long run. And I know I'm being secretive here, but I don't want to give away the plot because there's some interesting twists and turns.
That is true.
Oh, you bet.
That is true. So when you decided you were going to write this story, what was your first step?
Well, first I wrote a 9-page essay that was all about my grandfather. I actually called it Grandpa. And I just wrote up everything I had learned about him by asking people questions and what I remembered about him from my own experience and what my mother had told me about him and her mother, my grandmother. I didn't know my grandmother. I just knew my grandfather later in life. I knew him from the time I was about 5 until 11. So, you know, I saw him very frequently, almost once a week. And so that's the first thing I did. I wrote this 9-page essay. And then when I decided I was really going to delve into it, I looked at a lot of census records to find out where everyone was. In fact, my cousin Jim had sent me a copy of the census record for the orphanage where the kids were. So then I had a date. And I had a location. So my Aunt Dorothy had said he had sent us to some other state like Arkansas or someplace. Well, the orphanage was near a town in Kansas called Arkansas City. So that was her impression from when she was a little girl. You know, she was only about 7, so she had heard Arkansas, and she thought she was in the state of Arkansas at that time, when actually it was in Winfield, Kansas. So those are the kinds of things that I started fleshing out, and learning where people were helped me decide how to structure the story.
How did this cousin come to have that census data from the
orphanage? Well, I think he just looked it up. I think he just looked it up in the census records, and I think he may have known that it was in Kansas, and I didn't. I was the first looking in Arkansas because of what my Aunt Dorothy had said. So there are genealogy sites where if you look up the names of particular people in a particular year, you can find out where they were located by the census records. So, for instance, if he looked up the name of our oldest aunt that was in the orphanage, Aunt Marie, and asked for a 1930 census record, he would have immediately found that she was in the orphanage because they were all listed there.
Okay. So when Dorothy said this and you're like, Okay. What was this about? Was she surprised that you didn't know? Was she embarrassed that she had let something slip that she meant to keep secret? Or how did she respond to your shock?
She wasn't embarrassed at all. I was absolutely stunned. I was shocked. I thought, wow, what else did my mother not tell me? You know, and then gradually found out that there were other things she didn't tell me. And no, Dorothy just kept on talking and she told me more about the story. And it was sort of like, well, you ought to know this. Her attitude was, you ought to know this. And she was very open about it, about what she could remember from, you know, because she was only 7 and 8 when she was in the orphanage. They were there for at least a year.
And then they had kind of a chaotic life.
They did. They did. And I felt like the girls kind of had to grow up too fast. The two older girls ended up taking care of the kids a lot of the time because my grandmother couldn't handle all of it, you know, and the money was spread pretty thin. My grandfather's salary was what they lived on. And I recently found a letter from my Aunt Marie saying that she had gotten vegetables from a vegetable vendor and traded with him because they couldn't always afford to buy food. So it was tight and it was not an easy life. And the family was split up in 1930 and then some of them got back together. I mean, it was, like you're saying, very chaotic, and they were spread out over several states.
And yet they, most of them stayed in touch.
Yes.
Over the years.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I think when my grandfather took them to the orphanage, the youngest kids, I think he thought that that was going to be the last of it, that they would never see them again. But things changed.
Well, yeah, we don't want to give away too much of why this happened and so forth. But the one that I felt the sorriest for was Frank Jr.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't really know if the way I portrayed what he was doing in 1930 and 31 was accurate. And I asked his daughter to tell me if she knew where he was, because the orphanage wouldn't take him because he was 14. And that was too old for a boy. Girls they could place, because a lot of times people wanted an older girl to help them with the housework and stuff, you know, so it wasn't hard to place older girls. But a boy who was 14 was, at that time in 1930, he was just about ready to start working if he didn't stay in school. And it was interesting. All the boys did eventually graduate high school, but not all the girls. And that was partly framed in that era when people didn't think it was important for girls to have an education, because all they were going to do would be, and they would end up getting married and having babies. So why did they need an education? So, yeah. And I did feel sorry for Frank too. And he turned out, I knew him and I felt that, I mean, he had a sense of humor. He was a tease. And I felt that he kind of had a chip on his shoulder. So that may have been true and may not. Maybe my interpretation.
Well, you can't blame him if he did.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he essentially got abandoned at age 14, or not even. He wasn't even. Yeah. Was he?
Yeah, he was. He turned 14 when they had taken him to the orphanage.
Wow. Yeah.
That's pretty young man, I think. You know.
Yeah.
To be out on his own. But my grandfather only had, I think, a sixth grade education, and he had to go to work on his parents' farm. So I think that in those days there was an attitude of, well, you know, if that's what you have to do, then you'll find your way. There were a lot of, especially 1930, after the stock market had crashed, there were a lot of young men that were on the loose.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a book that we had on the show years ago that recently was made into a movie, The Boys in the Boat. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. Great movie.
Yeah, and it was a great book, too. And one of the boys on that crew team had been abandoned by his family because of the Depression. And
right.
Yeah, he was on his own living in
I should read that book.
Yeah,
I'm going to make
yeah.
a note.
It's a great book. So you started out getting kind of the bones of the factual, of the facts of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not going to interest readers, just the facts. So you have.
Right.
So how did you blend in fiction or, you know, the creativity to make it a novel? Like, how did that, what was that process like?
When I wrote my memoir I finished it in 2017. I worked with a great editor who told me that I needed to create more scenes and dialogue in order to illustrate the things that happened to me in my life, that was much more interesting to people than just telling about it. And so I had practice in that already. So what I knew I needed to do was to create personalities for these characters that for the ones that I actually didn't know very well. I did know my grandfather, so I had a basis for him, that he was kind of removed, not particularly humorous, a little bit, slightly affectionate, but I got the impression that he didn't really care for kids very much because he certainly rarely related to me. And so I knew a little bit about people, and I knew what my mother had told me. I also knew the way my mother spoke, and I figured that that was, you know, the vernacular that she used was likely the vernacular that the family used. And they were country people. They weren't particularly sophisticated, although education then was actually better. I mean, children were learning algebra and geometry earlier than they do now in those days. And I know that my mother read the newspaper every day, and I know that my father and my grandfather did. So that's, they did stay up with current events in that way. So I knew that much about them. So because of what I knew about what my grandfather had done, and I didn't really approve of some of the actions that I had recently learned that he had taken, I had a more sympathetic attitude towards my grandmother. My mother did not really care for her mother that much. And I think that that's part of why she didn't tell me this story. She disapproved of some of the things that Naomi, the character Naomi, my grandmother, had done. So she, held it against her. But I also knew that in talking with my aunts and uncles, I knew that my mother was more like her father. So I figured that the other girls were, and some of the boys were probably more like my grandmother, and she must have been a sweeter, nicer person than my grandfather and my mother. So I had those clues in order to create people, and I had the practice of learning to create, because I feel like in a book, when an author says he was a wonderful person, I'm not interested in that person. What I'm interested in is what they do and what they say, and that tells me who they are, what their character is. So I tried to illustrate who I thought their personalities were by doing it with dialogue and actions. And with regard to my grandfather, I realized that he was going to be very one-dimensional if I only told him from my point of view. And I felt kind of flummoxed by how I was going to create a personality for him that everybody was, not going to completely hate right from the beginning. And so my meditation teacher said to me that she had learned this practice regarding people that you don't care for very much. And it was to say something like this: my grandfather had feelings just like me. My grandfather loved his children just like me. My grandfather loved his wife just like me. So that you begin to be able to relate to them in a way that, you know, perhaps the actions that they took were out of personality traits that they really couldn't even help because of the way they'd been raised. So I'm sorry to go on so long, but
No, that's perfect. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Francine Falk Allen, author of A Wolf in the Family.
So how did you choose that title? That was interesting.
Well, I wanted a last name that was also Germanic. So since their last name started with W, I went into the list of Germanic last names, and I found Wolf, and I thought, well, that's perfect, given a couple of the things that happened in this story. And we really went, my editor and I, my publisher, we really went through a lot of different titles, and nothing was clicking. And then a woman in my writing group said, I keep thinking of a line in the Harry Potter books, and that was, I think there's a witch in the family. And she said, that's what I think of when I have read your book, because she was an advanced reader. And I said, a wolf in the family, that's perfect. So that's what we decided to do. And my editor and my publisher both liked it too. So I thought, okay, yeah, this is good. It's intriguing, and that's what I wanted.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is a character in the book who may or may not have been related to the family. There, mm-hmm. And at the time, of course, it would be very hard to tell whether they were or not. But I'm wondering if you have ever tried, like with 23andMe or Ancestry.com, to find out if there were people that you didn't know about that were related to you.
Someone contacted our family about a year or two ago saying that there was a child that was related to someone that had been born out of wedlock. And I haven't followed up on that, but that may be true. That may be true. And one of the characters in the book that Naomi's mother says has a distant relationship to the family is a cousin. I looked that up. I went back as far as I could into family research on archives and ancestry. And I found that he was, in fact, a distant cousin of the family.
Okay.
So, and it appears that at least my mother and my sister both told me that he was Native American. I mean, they called them Indian then. So, right. So that comes up in the book.
Right, right. One of the kind of key issues in this book is gender inequality and how that impacted your grandmother, your aunt, your mother. In fact, you mentioned that not all the girls graduated high school, and your mother was one who was forced to drop out of school to work at a fairly young age. And do you think she resented that?
Oh, yes. Yes. She really did. I mean, my mother was a resentful person anyway. Anything that went wrong, she could, like, she got mad at me when I was 13 and barely spoke to me for about 4 years, you know, so she could really hold a grudge. But when she told me about having to quit school and go to work, she told it with an attitude that basically, you're damn lucky you didn't have to do this. You get to finish high school. And she didn't say that, but that's what her attitude was. And I could tell that she really resented it. And then she went back eventually and got her high school diploma. It was really important to her. She didn't want to be treated like she was a hick, you know, like she was a country person who was uneducated and unsophisticated, which she was. But she didn't want that to be the persona that she presented. And it was when she spoke. She was talking to someone on the phone that she knew really well. She would say things like, well, we had to go to the store. But when she spoke to someone she didn't know, especially for the first time, she would speak like this. I told Francine that we were not able to go on that day. She was very careful about her diction. So it was really important to her that she presented that kind of a face. And I know she really resented having to leave school. She resented having to take care of the kids, too.
Well, you know, sometimes we have this idea that these you know, big happy families from the past, the Walton kind of thing. And I got to admit that every big family from the past that I knew about had a lot of not so great things going on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult, particularly for the women, because they were, I mean, my husband and I have rather a traditional relationship now. I'm not working anymore, so I handle the house, and he's still working, and I do everything I can. And, you know, I'm only able to do so much because I have a disability, but I don't resent it because he's supporting me, and he also is willing to pay for extra help. But in those days, people didn't have a salary for extra help unless they were upper class.
Right.
You know, especially after the stock market fell, even people with a lot of money didn't have money for personnel.
Francine, how did you research what it was like working on the railroad in that time?
I knew something about it, not a lot. I looked up schedules, and I knew that my grandfather had not been home a lot because that had been told to me. And I knew that from the research I did about the railroad that men would be gone. You know, your run would be, say, Ogden to Chicago. So that took time, and it would stop places in between, and they'd have an overnight. And so I figured, you know, he's probably gone for anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks at a time, a lot of the time. And I read up on other things about the railroad. That's how there's one story about a rail trip that they take. And that comes out of my research, that there were young boys who would get on the train and sell sweets and newspapers, and they had a limited amount of food. They had kitchens on every train at that time if it was going any distance, but it wasn't necessarily the food that you would get at a station house. And there were some, the bigger towns had station houses where you could stop and get food. So I researched all that, and I researched how long, I looked at train schedules and found out how long it was going to take them to get from Ogden to Kansas City, and then they would have had to take like a truck or a buggy to get to my grandmother's farm because the rail didn't go that way, you know. So I looked up all this stuff. I also read a Wallace Stegner book that was set in that area, and he talks about how his parents lived and he grew up with them. So he knew something about that time frame. So I did my research.
So in the book, Naomi, who would be your grandmother, takes several trips back to visit her parents in Kansas or Missouri?
Kansas and Oklahoma.
Kansas
first
and Oklahoma.
Kansas, okay. And then Oklahoma.
Okay. And do you know if she, and she, usually she didn't take all the kids. She took some of the kids with her.
Yeah, right.
Do you know if that really happened?
I know it happened. I don't know how often she went by herself, but my mother had told me that because my father was a railroad man, the whole family had free tickets to ride on the train any place in the United States that they wanted to go. But of course, in those days, if you had time to go someplace, you went to visit your family. So I just figured that, because I knew my mother took the train a lot, so her mother must have.
Right, right.
How much is this is fiction? How much of it is reality? I get kind of confused sometimes with the story.
The major events in the story are true. And I created how they would have happened. Like, how did different people meet? That part I had to create. I didn't know for sure how some different people had met. But
sure,
all the characters in the book actually existed. All of them. And I don't know how to say this. I don't want to give away which things are true and which aren't true. My grandfather definitely took the children to an orphanage. That really happened. They really lived in the orphanage at the time that I have them living there. The reasons he took them were true. The what happened beforehand that led him to do that, those were true events. And the actions that some of the other family members took afterward were actually true. And the character Marie, who came from Germany, that part is essentially true. There are some things about her and her first husband that I had to make up. But she became my step-grandmother much later. So after my grandparents were no longer together. So the structure of it is true. And I made up the personalities and how people met and, mostly the things that they said. But for instance, my mother told me that my grandmother bit her nails. Her mother bit her nails and she just hated it. So I wrote that into the book and I figured a person who bites their nails all the time is probably very self-conscious and also probably nervous. So that helped me create Naomi's personality because I knew that about her, that she was a nail biter. So those are little bits and pieces of things that I put in. And most of the vignettes about my mother are things that actually happened that she had told me.
Ah.
That she got her tongue stuck on a pump once and and she tied a rag around her head to straighten out her nose because she hated her nose. So there are lots of things. She did eventually work at a boarding house where the woman said, "Don't you know," all the time. So a lot of things like that are based on fact.
And her how she met her first husband and moved to California, is that all factual also?
Yeah, he was a baker in Ogden, and I don't know that she met him at the bakery, but she met him in Ogden.
Yeah. Did you know him?
No, but I met him once, and it was awkward. He was at my sister's house because he was my my sister's father, and I knew things about him, and I felt kind of awkward and embarrassed meeting him, and we just said hello and happened to be in the same room for a little while, and I spent most of the time in a different room, and I didn't know how I should relate with him because, he had divorced my mother. So, at that time felt like I sort of had an allegiance to my mom. And I had to, I asked my niece because she knew him. He was her grandfather, so she knew him. And I asked her about his personality to some degree. And then I had the things that my mother had told me about him and that my sister had told me about him. But yeah, I did meet him.
Well, Francine, why don't you read a little bit from A Wolf in the Family?
Okay, I'll do that. So now we've talked a little about the family. So you've heard a little bit about them. There were Frank and Naomi are the primary characters. And this first chapter is January 1930. The depression, or actually the stock market had fallen just a few months before. So this is chapter one, takes place in Ogden, Utah, January 1930. And people that are mentioned in here, Mrs. Woods is a boarding house matron, and Frances is Frank's eldest daughter, my mother, and Anita is her sister, who's just a year younger than she is, and then Naomi is his wife. Frank Wolf stepped off the train into the cold night fog and onto the even colder concrete platform at Ogden Station. He shivered involuntarily, steeling himself against the damp air. He stifled a second shudder. One more trip on the Union Pacific line, home again, but this time was unlike any before, and he didn't intend to make the trip to Winfield, Kansas again, unless the railroad sent him through that area. He ran his hand over his sandy-colored, pomaded hair. Minnie hated it when his hair was out of place, and he liked that about her. A tidy woman, as it should be. They were so well matched. If only she'd been available more than 20 years earlier. He was amused that she wanted him to refer to her as Mrs. Woods around others. They never used first names in public. Well, only in the boarding house kitchen in front of her kids, and his children when they'd been there. Oh, it would be good to get back to her next month. He was tired, beyond tired, exhausted. He had not expected this sadness to fatigue him. He had not expected even to feel sad. Every step felt heavy. Well, it was done. What I've done for the benefit of all concerned, he told himself. And the children would be better off in the long run. He'd been surprised by the elegance of the old house acquired by the Lutheran Children's Home. It was much swankier than their modest home in Ogden had been. The children would likely go to good homes, at least they'd probably be Lutheran, and maybe to families who were well off. Sometimes when people adopted, it was because they had no children and had more money to spend on the ones they took in as a result. And he knew that sometimes people adopted children because they needed more farm labor. Well, it wouldn't hurt the children to do some hard work if that came to pass. Mein Gott, I did farm work myself as a teenager. It was tough, and would be tougher for younger kids. He put those thoughts out of his mind for now, best not to dwell on what he had no control over. He paused inside the tall, airy lobby. This was one of the loveliest terminals on his route. He never tired of the architecture. He sat down on one of the polished wooden benches, his worn leather overnight satchel beside him, and glanced around to see if anyone had left the newspaper. He just needed a moment to himself, a moment of stillness. He picked up an Ogden Times left by a traveler. Ach, gut, today's edition. A man needs his daily paper. He found the advertisement for the sale of the house. Good, the agent had done his work. Hopefully Anita had gone by there and cleaned the place up to show it. He wished Frances were still around. She was a pro at house cleaning. Naomi would have missed her home, her domain, her better kitchen, the whole place. But he sure didn't want it. Too many memories. Minnie Woods would never leave her house, he knew. Women got so attached to location. Besides, the Woods house was, well, quite a house. Almost new. He loved being on the railroad and all the stops in between, the freedom of being gone for weeks, months at a time. But he also liked being anchored in one place and the stature he gained through his steady home life. Well, there's nothing for it but to go home for the moment. A beer would taste good right now and help him sleep, but oh well, he'd have to do without. How long could Prohibition go on? Maybe he would call Mother in Missouri tomorrow to let her know he'd arrived and check on Carl and Henry. Or he could just write a letter. That would cost less. Now that's a look ahead, because most of the book takes us from 1918 through the 1940s and even on into the 50s. So this next piece is a trip that they took to Kansas to the farm where Naomi's mother owned a farm, and they had kind of a little family reunion there, and they had traveled on the train. Back in the house, Frank had seen Naomi out the window having a conversation over by the corral. When she came to his side, he asked her, "What were you talking about with that Indian?" "Now, Frank, I'm not sure he's an Indian," she said. "He might be. I can see that he does kind of look like one, but he talks just like anybody else, like any farmhand. His name's Forland. That sounds like a white name to me. Maybe English, like Sims, even. Plus, he's related to the Chalmerses. We were just talking about the horse. You know, that Josie's been on our farm since I was young. Sis told me he was from Dover. He said his family's got a farm there, but they didn't need him for the summer, so he came down to help Mama. That's all we talked about. It's okay for me to have a conversation with my mother's farmhand, isn't it?" Frank was thinking the guy was a little too good-looking, even for an Indian. Rough around the edges, not a city fellow, but still something about him. And there'd been that waiter at the station house. "Man, oh man, I told you before, you need to be careful talking to strangers. They might think things." "Oh, for heaven's sake, Frank, I'm home with the kids 24 hours a day while you're gone talking to who knows who every day when you're on the railroad. Here I am, pregnant again, surely not of interest to any man. and I took a little walk over to the corral to see the horse for a few minutes. A body never gets time to herself. I just like a little adult conversation once in a while, other than the Iceman at home and my mother here and women at the church. No harm in that. You know it doesn't mean anything. She bit a fingernail, searching her fingers for one that wasn't down to the quick. Listen, believe you me, I don't like some Indian or half-breed or whatever he is, thinking he can just talk to my wife anytime he likes, especially alone. Frank knit his brows. He's not family, he's a hired hand. You should only be talking to him if you need to ask him to do a chore, and he's your mother's worker anyhow. You bet she can tell him what to do. And you know, I don't like it when you talk back to me. Don't be getting uppity. She shook her head, smiling, put one arm around his waist, and gave him a squeeze. Actually, he's mother's distant cousin by marriage. Then how'd they get that Indian blood in there, Frank thought. He didn't approve. Frank stood up straight and looked away, but he put his arm around her as well and gave her a pat on her hip, enjoying his wife's affection and comely little body, even with its swell of pregnancy. Now, Naomi eventually develops a friendship with Charles the farmhand, and a lot of things go on over the next several years. I'm skipping forward to 1929, and this is a letter that Naomi wrote. Short one. 3051 Grant Avenue, Ogden, Utah, May 3rd, 1929. Dear Charles, if you can help it, don't let my mother see this. I didn't put my address on the outside of the envelope, and I hope you get to the mail before she does, because she'll probably know my handwriting. Clarence blurted out something about you and me holding hands about a week back. Now, Clarence is her youngest son, and he had been to Kansas with her. Clarence blurted out something about you and me holding hands about a week back. I said he was mistaken, and you were just handing me a shirt to mend, but Frank about blew a gasket. He asked me a lot of questions. I never told a lie before, but I learned real fast. Things aren't too great around here. I hope you are well and that Daddy is feeling better. Please don't tell them I wrote to you. I just thought you should know. Your friend, Naomi Wolf. And then she's thinking, She hadn't known how to sign it. Your friend? Ha! What if somebody sees this? Now they'll know we held hands. Oh, my land. So she writes, P.S. Please burn this. N.W.
And that was Francine Falk Allen reading from A Wolf in the Family. So, Francine, did you write the book chronologically?
I did, yeah. But I wanted the first chapter to be a look ahead, because I wanted to set the scene that Frank had taken these kids to an orphanage, and you want to know why. And you can assume that it's because times are hard financially, because most people know that in 1929 the stock market had fallen, especially people who've read a lot of history or historical fiction. But that actually isn't the case. So I just wanted to set up that little deception in the beginning that he had taken the kids to an orphanage, and you want to find out why, and then go back in time to set up the way their life was from 1918 through 1930.
Did you have any actual correspondence between family members from any of this time period?
No, I didn't. I had what people had told me when I interviewed them. I had a letter from my Aunt Marie, and I had also talked to my my Aunt Sis, who's in the book, who I call Anita. And both Marie and Sis told me that my grandfather had beat the boys. And my mother had – I had asked my mother one time, because she used to paddle me. And I asked her, who was it that paddled you? And I said, was it Grandpa? And she said, Daddy never hit us. But her two sisters said that he did. And he hit the girls too. So, yeah. Yeah, I had some information, but it wasn't letters that were written by any of the family members, except my Aunt Marie.
But that was to you. It wasn't from
that
time period.
That was to me. That wasn't in that time frame.
Yeah. I wonder if there's any around anywhere, because people wrote letters to each other back then.
Well, my mother wrote letters, and I do have a box full of old letters, but they were later, you know, the 1950s, so it wasn't during that time frame. And I read all of them because I was looking for family information about 20 or 30 years ago when I started doing genealogy work. But it was mostly I kept them for, like, somebody died, somebody got married, somebody was born, you know, just factual information like that. And there was never any mention about, you know, any of that. Although my mother also kept in touch with her youngest sister, who was born much later in the story.
Half sister or full sister?
Yeah, half sister.
Half sister. Yeah.
And then I knew her half brother, my uncle, who lived down the street with my grandfather.
Wow. So did you know the half sister, Naomi's youngest?
No. I never knew her, and she's not alive anymore, unfortunately. So, I mean, you know, I don't know if she would have been happy to hear from me, especially if she knew I was going to write this story, but I have pictures of her. There are a couple of pictures of her as a little girl in the back of the book.
And did she have children that you're in, that you know or don't know, or
I think she had a son and that he has died too. Because I was looking down that line, you know, I looked her up too in the genealogical records.
So it sounds like your interest in genealogy predates writing this book.
That's absolutely true. And I mostly went after my father's family, partly because I had a lot of affection for my father. And also he died when I was very young. So I had an interest in what his background was. And I ended up meeting cousins who had done a lot of the early work, and I ended up going to Ireland and looking up a lot of his relatives. That was really fun. Such a good trip.
It seems like there was a time period in the early 1900s that people were interested in genealogy, or maybe it's the mid 1900s, because my mother, mom's family, her mother's family was also a large farm family in Iowa, and one of your cousins did a lot of genealogical research a long time ago, or was it your aunt?
The Mormon relatives, the sisters and their children were really into genealogy.
Yeah.
The reason they do it is because they believe that you can baptize for the dead. So they're very zealous about doing this. But I did find that some of the information that they put in was suppositions. And I did talk to my cousin who's done most of the work. And I told her, you know, you're assuming some dates and things like that. And if you assume a date, you need to put a C in front of it for circa, because you couldn't possibly have found a record on this. There is no record. You know, there's no record of the date when my grandparents got married. There's no marriage record that I can find anywhere, and I know that they did, but and we assume they must have been married in early 1908 or late 1907. But my cousin put in exactly 9 months to the day before my mother, the first child. I said, you know, that's kind of a stretch, so you need to put circa in front of that.
Yeah.
So I don't completely trust all the work that the Mormon relatives did. It may be pretty good, but it may not be 100% accurate. Anything I put in my records, I've seen the birth records or the death records or the marriage records. I don't put anything in, you know, unless I put circa. So,
so Caroline, who was it on your mother's family that did all that research way back when? Was it Lucille's mother?
Probably, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
Julia Cating. Yeah. And then there was someone on your father's side that was really interested in the genealogy too, I think.
Well, I really didn't have too much to touch with them because my dad and his brother were estranged. And so, you know, I didn't really have too much.
The reason I'm saying this is because we have handwritten genealogical records or hand typed from three out of the four sides of my family. So my mother's father and my mother's mother and my father's father's family. Nothing from my father's mother. I don't have that. But but her family came from France not too long before, whereas the rest of these had all been, had immigrated to the United States in between the 1600s and the 1800s, so pretty early on.
Yeah,
and
right.
So we have a lot of historical data. Are there more stories from your family to tell?
There's a great story from my dad's side, and I'm kind of tired of the publishing process and the marketing, especially. I like doing these podcasts. This is the fun part. But I'm trying to decide what to do. I think that what I might do is start writing short stories, but I don't know if I'll ever put it into a book about my dad's family. My four times great grandmother has an interesting story, and there's a whole lot of stuff about the people who immigrated from Ireland and how they ended up on both sides of the Civil War. And I figured that's a good, you have to have some stress in a book for it to be a good book. And they stayed in touch with each other, but you know, some of the members were fighting on the Confederacy side, and some of them on the North side were either in the Union Army or they were financing the Union side. But they stayed in touch. You know, it's amazing to me the things that families can withstand. Like these days, that's going on too.
Yeah, really.
Know.
Yeah.
When you were saying that that the two brothers were estranged, I recently talked to one of my cousins who was, you know, the daughter of one of the brothers in the story, and I said, did he stay in touch with his brother, because we think his brother was gay. It seems that he was gay.
Right.
And she said, no, they weren't in touch. So I think that he was ostracized because he was homosexual, you know, which is something that I believe a person doesn't really have a choice about. I know some people think that they do, but that's just my belief. So anyway, so it's interesting how families do have estrangements. Even those two were twins. I thought surely they must have stayed.
Yeah,
you know, so that was, I was sorry to hear that, actually.
Well, Francine, we're out of time today, so I want to thank you for joining us to talk about A Wolf in the Family. And Caroline, do you have a closing quote for us?
Well, I'll tell you that the thing about gender inequality and that the women had no power back then, but some of the daughters overcame that and were, you know, I was just interested in the whole thing, and the gender inequality is still around.
And No kidding.
And so I don't suppose it'll ever change, but women are stronger now than they were back then. And so maybe there's, you know, maybe it will change, but I really enjoyed this book. I really did.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad. And anybody that has enjoyed it, I deeply appreciate if people give it a good rating or review on Amazon or Goodreads, because that really helps get the word out about the book. I'm sorry to do a little self-promotion there, but
that's quite all right.
Pretty important. So,
well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.